I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. This is a radio show, if you happen to know it, that traverses the globe in search of wonder, and our next guest, Jonathan Drory, seems to understand this habit of ours, insofar as we did visit with him last time about his book, Around the World in 80 Trees. This time we're going to be on a journey with him around the world in 80 plants, which is the title of his latest contribution. Part of me actually is hoping to learn about some exotic plants, although you have to confess, exotic, that's always a matter of one's point of reference. But I'm also very much hoping for him to chat with us about some vegetative forms of life that are common, expressly common, like the potato or the tomato, plants that, for whatever reasons, we tend to think of as simple or humble or maybe a bit wanting in the wonder department. If anybody can persuade us otherwise, he certainly can. Jonathan Drory is a trustee of the Eden Project and an ambassador for the World Wildlife Fund, was previously on the board of the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew, and he's produced dozens of projects for the BBC. It's an honor to have him back with us again. Jonathan Drory, welcome back.
Thanks for having me. Hi.
We're going to get to tomatoes and potatoes and their wondrous ways in just a moment, but as a little bit of a preamble to that, could I invite you maybe to share with us a few tips, just a small handful of tips for overcoming the condition that I've heard you refer to as plant blindness?
Yes, I remember being with a botanist in the Andes once, and I was being very quiet, and I was watching this wonderful, wonderful hummingbird, a species that is actually the largest hummingbird on the planet. It's about the size of my fist. And I was watching this thing, and I called the guy over, and I said, look, isn't that amazing? I was kind of whispering so I didn't scare the bird. And he looked at it, and he said, oh, it'll be fantastic when the bird gets out of the way and I can see it properly. Because, of course, he thought that I was pointing at the plants. And, you know, he had the reverse of plant blindness. You know, he could only see plants. And I realized that it's really a sort of a matter of upbringing and point of view. And I think that human beings, you know, we're kind of programmed to look at things that move and to react to them. And that's been, you know, jolly useful for our evolution. But, you know, plants get up to the most amazing things if only we would sit and observe them for a bit. And, you know, you can sometimes do that with time-lapse photography or what have you. But if you just sort of look at plants and look at the relationships they have with insects and with each other and with us, I think they become really interesting. And it's almost like you have to go into another frame of mind to see them.
Now, you said that it's perhaps a matter of upbringing, and that invites me to ask you about your own upbringing. I understand your parents were very much conducive to your learning about plants.
Yes, I grew up in southwest London and over here in England, and that was very close to the Royal Botanic Gardens at Kew. And my father's first love really was botany, even though he retrained as an engineer. And my mother loved plants for their beauty. And so between them, my brother and I got this sort of wonderful conditioning, I suppose, to look at plants. And my parents used to jolly us along, you know, obviously with the usual encouragement of kind of cakes and things. But also they used to tell us stories about the plants you know, tell us what they were used for and some folk tales and things like that. And also used to feed us bits of them. To say, well, what does this one taste like and that one? And obviously my father had enough knowledge to make sure he didn't actually poison us. But I remember having a lick of an opium poppy, and it just made my tongue go ever so slightly numb for a second. And the effect on my teacher when I told her at school was much more exciting, though, because I think they sent round a social worker to make sure that I wasn't being abused.
Well, for the children, that's great to have parents who will help you get there. But if you're already well into adulthood and you think, well, maybe I'm a little bit plant blind, you say observation. Any other tips there?
I mean, I think the big tip is that, you know, particularly if you're in the United States, where you're never really that far from a botanic garden, I would go to your local botanic garden and go on one of the tours. You know, they're usually very cheap or even free. Someone with knowledge will show you around. And it's just like going around an art gallery. You know, if you have someone who's kind of really enthusiastic, pulling you by the elbow and saying, "Look at this! This is fantastic!" Their wonder transfers itself to you, and I think that's a great way in.
Now, suppose a hummingbird were hovering between me and, I don't care, shall we go with dandelion or potato or tomato plant, something that is generally regarded as mundane.
Okay. Let's go with tomato, or as I call it, tomato. You'll have to forgive me. The tomato is an amazing plant. It's in common with other flowering plants, it needs to get its pollen from the male parts of one flower to the female parts of another, carrying the male sex cells. And the way that it does that is to encourage some pollinator to come along and in return give it a little bit of nectar. So far so ordinary. But then the way that the tomato manages this is through something called buzz pollination. So a bumblebee or carpenter bee comes along, not just any old bee, and it raises its wing beat from the normal sort of humdrum beat of flight to something like a middle C, clamps itself onto the flower and vibrates its wings at a middle C, and that vibrates the pollen out onto the bee, which then goes off to another flower and fertilizes it. That's obviously wonderful, but here's the thing. If you play a high C to a loud note to green tomatoes, then you can delay their ripening for a week. Now, I think there are two amazing things about that. The first is that, you know, how incredible that sound can interact with the plant and delay the ripening. And secondly, isn't it amazing that someone discovered that? It was scientists in Korea about a year and a half ago. And how they, accidentally came across that, I don't know. I imagine someone had their hi-fi turned up a bit loud in the warehouse.
Well, are you conversant enough with this little phenomenon that, is the ripening delayed after a flower has already set fruit?
Yes. Yeah, so in other words, you have a fruit that is already, you know, looks like a tomato. It's not red yet, it's green. Those are, you know, when people go to pick those, they're usually picked green and then ripened artificially using a plant hormone called ethylene, unless you get the sort of vine-ripened ones. But for the mass production of tomatoes, that's how it's done. And then, obviously, it's actually quite useful for farmers to be able to delay the ripening because they don't want them all to ripen at once. So, having a plant that you can say, well, actually, let's dial this back by about a week, that could be quite useful.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure this out. If the plant were a sentient creature, is the plant then just saying to itself, oh, there are still bees in the proximity, and they must be doing their business, and I'm going to set more fruit before I... And I know that these tomatoes come in both determinate and indeterminate form. So some of them are setting fruit while still setting flowers, and others, they all come ripe at once. But have you figured it out?
This is something that works once the fruit has been removed from the plant. Okay, so you've picked it, you've picked the green tomato, and you've just got a pile of tomato fruit, and you play the sound to it, and it alters the way that the fruit itself is producing this sort of plant ripening hormone called ethylene. It sort of modulates that so that it doesn't produce so much of it if you play this loud high C sound to to the tomatoes.
Oh my goodness! This is even after harvest, then.
Oh yes. Yeah, absolutely. It's after harvest.
Yeah,
but,
I mean...
Years ago, our Prince Charles, who's sort of second in line to the throne here, people made fun of him for, saying that he sometimes talks to plants. And, there were people who, I think that really what he was getting at is that we should understand that human beings are not the only thing on the planet, and that we should, in our way, kind of listen to other organisms, not literally, but, you know, sort of take cognizance of the fact that they're there and valued. But actually, you know, sound does interact with plants. And in fact, there are some flowers that change the constituents of their nectar according to what insect is buzzing nearby. So if it's a moth, it'll get a different sort of selection of amino acids and sugars and things from if it's a bee. And the plant manages to change that sort of cocktail within 20 seconds or so. It's extraordinary.
Would you be of the mindset to be content with leaving the mystery of the delayed ripening of the tomato fruit, just leave that be? Or is that something we have to get down to the bottom of? We have to understand why.
Well, I mean, I think that's the sort of question that one might ask about a rainbow. it's beautiful in itself and a wonderful, wonderful thing. And if you understand the kind of refraction of the light through the raindrops and, you know, the kind of wonder of that, to me, it only makes it more wonderful.
Yeah. Well, I guess we're going to have to wait for more researchers to solve that one for us as to why the delay there. Do you have any insight into all of the swirling information that went about the idea that because it's from the nightshade family that tomatoes are poisonous and people steered clear of them? I understand in England they were just grown as ornamentation at one point.
That's right. The tomato is native to Central America, really, and the area sort of between Mexico and a bit further south. And the Spanish, the conquistadors, they sort of brought back tomatoes to Europe. They caught on pretty quickly, actually, in Spain and Italy, and had already been bred by the Aztecs into lots and lots of different varieties. There was a guy called Gerard who wrote a very famous herbal in 1597 in Britain. And he was a sort of suspicious character, suspicious of other people. And he thought, even though he knew that the Spaniards and the Italians were enjoying their tomatoes, described them as being the tomato fruit as being of rank and stinking savor. And he was very suspicious of them because they are of this Solanum family, which does contain, deadly nightshade and mandrake and all sorts of other things which are quite poisonous. So even though he knew they were good to eat, he kind of put about this rumor, which, because it was published in his herbal, it set back the marketing of tomatoes in Britain for about 200 years. And really, it wasn't until the, kind of early 19th century that tomatoes really took off in Britain, whereas everywhere else they were already very popular. And in the United States, they cottoned on much, much earlier and, saw them as a very healthy thing.
And would you remind me what year that publication came out where he was bad-mouthing them?
1597.
Oh, that's early. Yeah. So in Shakespeare's time, Shakespeare may have known about the plant but have shied away from eating one.
Yes. Yeah, Shakespeare would have been around then, wouldn't he? A bit or a little touch earlier, but he might well have known about the plant.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, I am a big fan of potatoes. Just because I eat them and consume them in probably greater quantity than I should. But they, too, have a connection with the nightshade family and this whole issue of poison. How long did it take before we warmed up to potatoes?
Well, potatoes were another one from South America. Really, the sort of center of the greatest kind of variety is in Peru. And they again were brought to Europe by the Spaniards, and the ruling classes in Europe pretty quickly cottoned on that potatoes were a terrific food and would make the peasants much more productive if they ate lots of them, and would probably support bigger population of peasants as well, which would be great for the aristocracy. So they really encouraged people to eat potatoes, and they came up with all sorts of ruses to try and get people to plant them and eat them. For example, the French sort of stationed guards around potato fields so that people would think, gosh, they must be really valuable. And the King of Prussia had a huge potato banquet, obviously, implying that if it's good enough for a king, it's good enough for anyone. The potato enabled populations in Europe, because you can get such a large amount of food and calories in such a small space, enabled populations to really expand. And, of course, the danger was that people started depending on them too much. And in Ireland, in the mid-19th century, the Irish lumper potato was the one variety that everyone planted. And, because potatoes are all clones of each other, propagate them by sort of taking pieces of the tubers, that's the sort of underground food stores, the bits we eat, the potatoes, and plant those. But every plant, because you're vegetatively cloning the plants, every plant is the same. And if every plant is the same, they're like identical twins, genetically the same, that means that any disease that affects one will affect all of them. And so potato blight was this sort of fungal, or sort of very similar to a fungus, a fungal disease, which caused the loss of the potatoes. And, what we learn at school, what we learned at school when I was a kid, was that this, vulnerability caused, enormous number of deaths, a huge number of people, more than a million people died, and millions of people emigrated. But of course, actually, the story is more complex. And what the story is really about is man's inhumanity to man, because there was actually plenty of other food around, but it was all being exported to England, which was the colonial power. Mm. And that was a very, very sad story, really.
Well, it's fairly well known among gardeners that if a tuber from a potato reaches sunlight, if it pokes its way above the surface of the soil, it's going to start doing photosynthesis, it's going to green up, and then that's the part of the potato you mustn't eat. Is this idea that some parts are edible and some parts you dodge, that goes across so many different plant varieties, is there just this constant dance that we're doing with plants to try to figure out how to, exploit them to our advantage?
Yes, yeah, and the whole history of domestication is that, really. If you think about watermelons, the wild watermelons 2,000 years ago were pretty horrible. There's one thing I just need to correct slightly, because you might end up with someone being a bit ill if they listen to what we said. But potatoes, if you leave them in the light, they do go green. The green stuff is not poisonous. The green stuff is just chlorophyll, which is in all green plants. But the green signifies that the plant has started producing other things. In other words, there's poisons being produced in the potato, and they're invisible to us. So if you have green potatoes, it's no good, I'm afraid, just cutting out the green bits. Yeah, you need to chuck that whole potato away.
Ah, I've never heard such a thing before.
Yeah, no, it's a little-known fact.
Ah, very interesting.
And the poisoning that you get from green potatoes, unless you have, absolutely mounds and mounds of them, is not going to kill you, but it can give you a nasty gastric upset, a nasty tummy ache.
Well, that's some consolation.
now to your question about whether the kind of dance we do with plants. Plants have needed to survive, and they've developed and evolved all sorts of ways to do that. Some of which are kind of very useful for us. So some of these sort of resins and latexes and so on are actually kind of plant defenses that we use for all sorts of things. But of course, plants don't always want to be eaten. They usually want to have their fruits eaten by something, because those things will then disperse the seeds. If you're a plant, you don't necessarily really want something to come and just sort of eat you up. So some of those plant poisons We've had to breed out of the plants by domestication. And an example would be the lettuce, wild lettuces are actually quite narcotic. But we've bred that out of them so that we can eat them as much as we like.
I'm eager to talk about dandelions with you. We're going to do that after a short break here on the show. Also, nettles. Nettles, for some reason, I've got a curiosity about why one would approach nettles at all. And you've got some reasons. We're going to talk about them in just a bit. We're visiting with Jonathan Drury about his book, Around the World in 80 Plants. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith. This is Constant Wonder. Thanks for joining with us today as we visit with Jonathan Drury about his latest book, Around the World in 80 Plants. Can we talk nettles and dandelions?
Yes, let's do that. Dandelions are one of those plants that, depending where you are in the world, people either absolutely love them. If you're in Estonia, people just really go for dandelions. They've got them everywhere. Or they hate them. So I've met people in the United States who don't like to have dandelions on their perfect green lawn because they think they look like weeds. I'm a bit of a fan of dandelions. In France, they eat the leaves in salads. They're rather good, and they also make a kind of jelly out of the flower heads. Which is sort of quite appealing. It's a bit like a marmalade or something. But the one of the things I really like about the dandelion is that, in common with many other plants, it's developed defense systems to stop it being kind of chomped up by insects and whatnot. Plants, remember, are rooted to the spot, literally. They can't run away if something tries to eat them. And the way that it defends itself is with a kind of latex, a sort of milky substance that exudes from the roots if you break them. So if you take a dandelion root and break it, you'll find that you get this sort of milky sap on your hands. And it turns out that milky sap is actually very similar to the milky sap to the latex from rubber trees. And during the war, the Second World War, when supplies of rubber from the Far East were disrupted, there were large fields planted in Eastern Europe and in the United States of dandelions for the purpose of breeding those dandelions to make to harvest rubber from them. And they managed to get this to the point where it was, sort of pretty good and kind of almost worthwhile. And then the war stopped and supplies restarted from the Far East. And so they sort of put that one on ice for a while. But just in the last decade or so, people have started using those breeds of dandelions again because we're sort of more worried now about chopping down rainforests to plant rubber trees. And in both the United States and Europe, there are projects to make car tires out of dandelion rubber. And the firm Continental, an American company, has tires on the market now which have a substantial amount of dandelion rubber in them.
As long as we're talking about the utility of certain plants to humankind, we should talk about kelp, because I don't think of kelp as being a plant, per se.
Well, everyone's idea of what a plant is slightly different, but my definition is that it basically something that photosynthesizes, takes carbon dioxide, in this case dissolved in seawater, and water, and turns those simple things into complex structures. And of course, kelp, in common with other seaweeds, does plenty of photosynthesizing. And kelp is a rather sort of beautiful stuff. There are two versions of it. There's the one we have in Europe, which is maybe about sort of 20 feet long at most. And then there are the Pacific kelp that you get off the coast of California, Washington, Oregon, which is absolutely huge and forms these enormous forests at sea where you've got an incredible amount of life that's supported. You know, all the tiny little critters that sort of grow in and around it support fish, and those fish support seals. Very, very productive. And there's a hypothesis called the kelp highway hypothesis, which is that the people who originally came from Central Asia over towards the United States, what is now the United States, they came around the Pacific Rim, supporting themselves as they went in boats along the edge from all the sort of wonderful things they could eat that were basically supported by the kelp that was growing.
So this is a fascinating story because it's parallel to that land bridge story, I suppose, but it's a sea bridge.
Yes, that's right. And kelp became very important during the Second World War as a source of a chemical called acetone. Acetone is a precursor chemical for making explosives with. And in California, there were these big vats where they fermented kelp. And I've never smelt it before, but I had a look at some early editions of Scientific American magazine, and the descriptions of the smell were kind of made me feel quite revolted, even after, you know, all this time later.
Well, not all plants are going to smell very good, I suppose.
I think especially when they're fermenting.
Well, I've skipped nettles, and I guess my acquaintance with nettles is that we have the stinging sort, and I've learned to identify those and to dodge them. But the usefulness of nettles, the nutritional value apparently is really remarkable.
Well, nettles have really quite a lot of uses. If you were a Roman soldier around 2,000 years ago, the absolute worst posting that you could have was to the northern border of England with Scotland, what is now Hadrian's Wall. And it was cold and unpleasant, and the people on the other side of the wall were trying to kill you the whole time. It was just the absolute worst one. And in order to kind of keep the cold at bay, they used to use bunches of nettles, which they'd kind of flagellate themselves with over the shoulders. And that sort of stinging sensation, if you kind of think of it in the right way and imagine that it's not pain, you can feel it as heat. Now, if you go out with a pair of, I suggest, rubber gloves and pick yourself some nettles, especially when they're relatively young, I would say, and just sort of pick about the sort of first 6 or 8 inches off the top, and you know, just boil those up the way that you would cook spinach. They're actually very good, and the sting goes away the instant you put it in hot water. It doesn't sting anymore. And the flavor is a little bit like spinach, but nutritionally they're really, really good for you. And of course they're free, so you know, quite an interesting thing to try. I would say it's best if you sort of chop up some onion and put in a few other sort of tasty ingredients with it, because it doesn't quite make a good soup on its own. I think it needs some other things. They have these very clever kind of stinging hairs, which are called trichomes, that have a tiny little kind of glass-like blip at the end that, as soon as you sort of touch it, it breaks off and injects you with a whole cocktail of drugs and things that sort of make you go ouch and stay away. And of course, they've evolved to do that to get rid of herbivores that would otherwise eat them. So, you know, if you see a field of nettles and hungry cows, the cows will remain hungry. They won't eat those.
How important is it to you, to the world, to me, to anybody, that that plants are such productive sources of different types of medicines?
I mean, medicine, clothing, all our food. If there was no photosynthesis, there'd be no life. So, everything depends on plants. Either we eat plants or we eat something else that eats plants. The medicines, most people in the world still depend on medicines straight from plants. And, you know, some of these are, you know, sort of very familiar stories. You know, so aspirin, for example, that originally came from willows. There's drugs in the foxglove sort of family that are still very much used in heart medicine. In fact, they're very poisonous if you take too much of them. A lot of the spices that we have were used as antiseptics. You know, as I was saying, the plants have evolved these chemicals to defend themselves. Some of them are quite poisonous, but if you just have a little bit of them in the way that we use spices, they're actually sort of, you know, kill bacteria and keep food fresh. So turmeric, for example, is a very good it's a very good example of that.
I began our conversation with the word exotic. And is there a plant that still remains fairly exotic from your perspective that kind of gives you a bit of a thrill just to contemplate it because it's not growing in your neighborhood and it's in your and somehow made it into your book?
Yes. Well, there are a couple, I'd say. One is a plant called Welwitschia, which grows in the Namib Desert in Namibia in southwest Africa. And it can grow for 500 or 600 years in the most inhospitable environment. And it looks like the ugliest pile of sort of dead leaves that you could imagine. All the sort of bits shredded and coiled up. But as you get closer and closer, you see that this plant is actually a kind of a home for all sorts of other little animals, sort of insects, particular ones that live around this plant, and there are beautiful cones on it that have this wonderfully if you get up really close, a kind of fragrance to them. There are insects and lizards that feed on the insects and so on. And it's just such a, you know, the European botanists, when they first spotted it back in the 19th century, just kept describing it as the ugliest plant ever, and I kind of love the idea of this sort of thing living for centuries and centuries, and then people coming along and thinking that it's ugly. The other one that I think is very exotic is a plant called Iboga, which is a plant that's a shrub with beautiful apricot-coloured fruit on them, about the size of an almond, and the twigs of this tree are used in initiation rites by the local Bwiti culture, which is a sort of amalgamation of African tribal religions, pagan religions, and Catholicism. It's a sort of syncretic religion. And this plant is given to people who are about sort of 17 or 18 or so. And in that context, they have visions of their ancestors and their future. They see themselves as part of a continuum, which, you know, in the way that, you know, you can imagine alcohol, which we use as a drug in the West, is something that, you know, if it's in the context of football hooligans, it's a really bad idea. And if it's in the context of a glass of wine with a meal with a family, it's a completely different thing. And similarly, in that context, that mind-altering drug has some rather kind of good aspects as far as the society goes. But interestingly, that same drug seems to be useful as a therapy for heroin addicts in the West. So it's something that can wean people off heroin and quite quickly too. So that's one of the sort of more exotic ones in the book.
Last of all, do you sometimes feel like you missed the century for you to be alive in? Because you might have been along with Alexander von Humboldt, you know, discovering plants in the northern part of South America, or you know what? The idea of ship life was rough. I have to admit that.
I don't think I'd have enjoyed ship life very much, though I have read a lot of those sort of books, and Humboldt's accounts are actually just hugely good fun, mostly because I curl my toes and think, thank goodness I wasn't there. But the I've been on quite a lot of botanical expeditions with the Royal Botanic Gardens Kew and other organisations, and made films and written and so on about plants. And I still feel that there's so much to discover. So we're not discovering new countries anymore, but we are discovering new plants all the time. And for me, it's the relationship between the plant science and the crazy, bizarre, bonkers things that people get up to with those plants that is interesting. It's that sort of juxtaposition, I suppose, that I find fascinating.
Well, it's been wonderful to visit with you. Thank you so much for being with us again today.
Thanks for having me.
Jonathan Drory's latest book is titled Around the World in 80 Plants. I can't quit thinking about that botanist who didn't want a hummingbird to get in his way. Our next guest is actually a perfect counterpart to that, a naturalist who went far out of his way, all in search of hummingbirds. Stay tuned to Constant Wonder. I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. The truth is that any talk about plants will always dovetail quite nicely with talk about animal life. But we're not going to be talking about doves next. We're talking hummingbirds. John Dunn is a hummingbird fanatic, a world traveler in pursuit of these creatures, and author of The Glitter in the Green in Search of Hummingbirds. Dunn has traveled literally from pole to pole in his quest. I spoke with him a while back, and here's a highlight from our conversation. It begins with a trip he took to the Juan Fernandez Archipelago, far off the coast of Chile, to visit, believe it or not, Robinson Crusoe's Island, in pursuit of a hummingbird that lives only on that remote island.
I went there to see the Juan Fernandez Firecrown, and that is a bird found only on, there are three islands in the Juan Fernandez Archipelago, one of which is Isla Robinson Crusoe, and that bird is only found on that particular island, which makes it sound like the island's probably covered in them, but actually there's only one pocket of greenery on the island. A lot of the island is kind of your classic desert island. It looks like a moonscape. It's a very volcanic island. And in that one corner that's fertile and green, a lot of the sort of original endemic vegetation is gone. The island has been inhabited for a long time now by man, and mankind brought its usual handmaidens with it. And so sheep and goats and horses and cows, and then things like rabbits as well. So there's a lot of grazing, a lot of herbivores on there, which were knocking back the native vegetation. And it's kind of a parable or a metaphor for our stewardship of a lot of the world, if we're honest. It's not uniquely bad on the island. They also introduced eucalyptus trees at some point in the past, and brambles, which are smothering the ground, the understory, and also plenty of predatory mammals. And that is a particular problem for the hummingbirds. There are rats, both kinds, black and brown. There are mice. There are feral and domestic cats. At some point, some bright spark decided to introduce Coatim mundi from the South American mainland, which are a kind of an omnivorous and very tenacious mammal. And so the hummingbirds are up against it. And I went there thinking there were about 1,000 of these birds left on the island. This is what I'd read. This was the official statistic. And while I was there, I met a conservation team who were based on the island. They work for a fantastic NGO called Oikonos. And they're tasked with trying to conserve and improve the habitat that's left. And I spoke to one of the guys there and said, 1,000 birds, how are they doing? And he just laughed and said, there's not 1,000. We count the nests every breeding season. There's 400 of these hummingbirds left. And in 20 years, who knows? They may be extinct. And that was a really humbling moment because, a lot of the book is about joy and wonder and the pleasure that these birds bring to me, but also to the people who live in the places in which they're found. But to look a bird in the eye one-to-one and know that it could be extinct within my lifetime, that was really chastening.
Yeah. And there's an elegy in there. If in fact this bird is headed for demise, I'm wondering about the name of this bird. You say the fire crown?
Yes.
That's got to be descriptive of its head, I'm thinking.
Totally. Yes. Yes, it is. It's not a misnomer at all. There's a lot of hummingbirds have names which do describe exactly how they look. Although, I mean, fire crown does the bird no justice. The male, the whole bird is a beautiful, deep, burnt orange. And the crown, sure enough, has a particular iridescence. When the sunlight or light catches it at just the right angle, the whole head blazes with a sort of amazing golden shield. It's fantastic. But, I mean, all male and female hummingbirds, they're sexually dimorphic. They look different to one another. And usually the female is very drab. She's usually shades of green and white and grey, with maybe just a hint of colour. But on that particular island, the female of the Juan Fernandez firecrown is, if anything, more beautiful and striking than the male. And indeed, for decades, until as recently as the 1980s, biologists thought they were two totally different species because they looked so staggeringly different to one another. The female has a beautiful snow-white breast, but it's spangled with spots of ultramarine and beautiful sapphire blue. She's an astonishing-looking bird in her own right. Arguably, for my money, she's more beautiful than the male, and that's unusual with hummingbirds.
John, I wanted you to talk about the tongue of the hummingbird, because this is just some contraption.
It certainly is, Marcus. The hummingbirds, their bodies are remarkable, and you run out of superlatives to describe what makes up a hummingbird. They have almost twice the muscle mass devoted to powering their wings. Their hearts beat faster than any other bird, up to 1,000 beats per minute. And so the list of superlatives to describe their adaptations to their lifestyle is endless. But the tongues, even by hummingbird standards, are quite remarkable. If you see a hummingbird feeding at a flower, you'll sometimes see that tongue, or a hummingbird feeder in particular, you'll see that tongue darting out of the bill, and it looks filamentous and really fine. Early biologists who got their hands on a hummingbird specimens looked at the tongues, and they could see a kind of a groove running the length of that very long tongue. And they surmised that perhaps the birds were feeding by a capillary action. They were dipping their tongue into the nectar within a flower, and it was being passively drawn into the bird's tongue, and therefore into the bird. But I mean, when you think about it, that doesn't really make much sense. Nectar is kind of thick, gloopy, syrupy stuff, and for the time, the fleeting instant that a hummingbird's tongue is buried in a flower, there shouldn't be enough time for capillary action to deal with that and to draw the nectar in. And I love this because there are still things which we're learning about hummingbirds all the time. And a few years ago, some scientists decided to, they were concerned about this hypothesis of the capillary action. So they set up a hummingbird feeder with a transparent side, and they set up high-speed cameras to film a hummingbird feeding at this transparent feeder. And when they slowed the footage down, what they saw was absolutely amazing. Sure enough, in went the tongue. And when they zoomed in, what they realized was happening was the length of the tongue itself unfolded. And along the edge of the tongue, tiny little flaps opened up. So the tongue itself bloomed when it was submerged in liquid. And as the tongue was drawn back into the hummingbird's bill and into its head, the flaps and the tongue folded closed again. And what is actually happening, the hummingbird is in effect feeding passively, because as the tongue is drawn back in, all that nectar is trapped within the tongue. And as the tongue is pushed back out into the flower, all of the trapped nectar is forced back into the hummingbird's throat. So all the hummingbird has to do is just dip its tongue in and out of the nectar, and the nectar is passively drawn within it. So far more remarkable than the simple capillary action. And I kind of love, as a writer and a romantic, the symmetry here of a hummingbird visiting blooms to feed from. And when it does so, its very tongue blooms in the process.
You also describe where this tongue is situated within the skull of the bird. This is stunning.
Yeah. So, I mean, a hummingbird's tongue is a long thing. And again, if you look at a hummingbird feeding, it's extended beyond the tip of the bill itself. So all that tongue has to go somewhere. And again, this is kind of the nitty-gritty stuff which takes some dissection to see, but the tongue actually is coiled inside the skull and has to be withdrawn. It actually goes up almost around the eye sockets. So you've got to find somewhere to store a tongue as long as that, and hummingbird evolution has done just that.
Well, we all think of hummingbirds as being rather petite creatures, so it seems like a bit of a paradox to talk about a giant hummingbird. How giant is a giant hummingbird?
I'd love to imagine it was like a sort of Godzilla creature, but it's not like that. A giant hummingbird is about 20 centimeters long, and by hummingbird standards, that is big. Now, you guys have, unfortunately, one of our exports there in the United States. You've got European starlings. I think they're pretty much all over.
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah. It's approximately the size of a starling, to give you
that's enormous.
Yeah, that's a big bird. But when we turn that into sort of, you know, hard pounds, it's only 18 to 20 grams in weight. That's not that big. Now, I mean, compare that to the very smallest, to the bee hummingbird. That is just 5 centimeters, 6 centimeters long. And I just love this. It weighs between 1.5 and 2 grams. And that's a mind-bogglingly small amount for anything to weigh. That is less than a cent coin.
Yeah, yeah. So where would I find these two creatures, the giant hummingbird, the bee hummingbird? I think you mentioned Cuba. Did you say Cuba for the bee hummingbird or...?
Yeah, the bee is in Cuba and only there. And so, yeah, you're gonna need to get yourself to Havana and then head out into the countryside for your bee hummingbird. They're fabulous things. I mean, just smaller than you can possibly imagine a bird will be. And I spent days watching them. There was one particular garden which they were visiting. And it's a famous place to see the bee hummingbirds. And while I was sat there drinking a lovely cup of Cuban coffee and watching these birds, a succession of people turned up to see the bee hummingbird. These were tourists to the island who had made a several-hour round trip just to see the bee hummingbird. And it was so interesting to watch the reaction of visitors when they saw these birds, because it must have been how I looked when I first set eyes on one. My jaw dropped. You just can't conceive a bird could be so small. And watching the birds themselves, whenever a dragonfly flew into the garden, the bee hummingbirds just scattered and flew into the cover of trees and bushes, because a dragonfly is bigger than one of these birds. And I mean, dragonflies are very capable aerial predators, and the bee hummingbirds were treating them with a great deal of respect. Now, the giant hummingbird, on the other hand, they're found in South America. They're a little bit more widespread and found throughout a lot of the Andes. But they're pretty plain. They're not as beautiful as a great many hummingbirds. They're pretty dull and muted. So giant makes you expect something really spectacular. Nah, go with the little guy. He's far more interesting.
Now, am I completely deluded here, but are hummingbirds really exclusive to the New World, to the North and South America, or do we find them elsewhere?
Well, you're right and you're wrong. If we're talking about the present day, you're absolutely right. They are just found in the Americas and nowhere else on Earth. In every conceivable habitat, to be fair, from deserts, they're found in the Sonoran Desert in Arizona, and equally up above the tree line in the Paramo habitat, just below the snow line in the Andes. So they're found everywhere. And of course, all habitats in between, forests, rainforest, cloud forest, jungle, you name it, they're everywhere. But if we go back a few million years, just jump back in time, then there were still hummingbirds. And the oldest known hummingbird fossils which have been found in South America are 1 or 2 million years old, which sounds pretty old. But one day, a few years ago, a German paleontologist was looking at some bird fossils which had been found in a clay pit in Germany. And he realized that the structure of the wings of the morphology of the birds could only be one thing. It was a hummingbird. But the difference was the age of these fossils. They're around 30 million years old, which makes us realize that actually the hummingbirds originally evolved in Europe. And at some point in that 30 million year intervening period, they crossed into the Americas. And once there, of course, you know, you've now got, 300 species found throughout the Americas, more than that, in fact. They obviously diversified and evolved magnificently. But at some point, there was an extinction event back here in Europe, and the hummingbirds were lost to us, but happily not to you.
Well, I want to conclude with just whatever wisdom you might want to impart for those of us who care about creatures but perhaps have loved them to death. You know, I don't know if you're an expert on hummingbird care, but certainly there's quite the fad to feed them here with the hummingbird feeders. Not just the feeding. What's your best wisdom for how we should coexist with these animals?
Oh, my goodness. This applies, of course, to our everyday lives for everything, not just hummingbirds. We need to tread as lightly as we can upon the earth. If you've got a yard, try and plant nectar-rich flowers. I think the Audubon Society is a really useful resource for looking online to see which particular species do well in particular parts of the US. Yeah, I mean, and this is a win-win for you because you get beautiful flowers in your garden, but you'll attract hummingbirds. A hummingbird feeder is a wonderful thing for attracting hummingbirds to your garden. It's a great resource for a hummingbird to get an easy meal. But of course, you need to maintain them, change the sugar water very regularly, keep them scrupulously clean. Hummingbird feeder hygiene is really important. But if by all means put feeders in your gardens, that's great. But good insect friendly and hummingbird friendly nectar rich plants, that's the way, because there will be other beneficiaries, you know, us to see great beautiful flowers in the garden, but also insects, bees, all of these things really need good nectar bearing plants.
John Dunn, he is such a hummingbird fanatic that he has literally gone to great lengths as a world traveler in pursuit of these birds. He's author of The Glitter in the Green in Search of Hummingbirds. Now, exotic birds who wear fantastic plumage but can't slow down, that might be hummingbirds. Or it could be dancers at a discotheque in 1980. You've probably never danced at Studio 54, but we can give you a little taste of it. That's next here on Constant Wonder after the news.